Today is Friday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Israel and Morocco announced they will formalize relations.
This comes on the heels of 4 years of very, very hard work and very intense diplomacy.
Plus, the United States recognizes Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, but
Western Sahara is a disputed territory which was occupied by Morocco since 1975.
And a look at the new film, Driving While Black. We'll have these stories and more next. In a U.S. brokered deal, Israel and Morocco have agreed to recognize each other. This follows three other Arab countries, Bahrain, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates, recently establishing ties with the Jewish state, which several times since its modern founding in the late 1940s has found itself at war with its Muslim-majority neighbors. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman starts us off.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced the deal between Morocco and Israel on Twitter on Thursday, calling it a historic and massive breakthrough for peace in the Middle East. Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner says it is a continuation of the president's regional diplomacy known as the Abraham Accords.
This comes on the heels of 4 years of very, very hard work and very intense diplomacy.
Kushner predicts more countries will normalize ties with Israel. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
In addition, President Trump signed a proclamation recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara, a former Spanish territory where international negotiators have failed to resolve a long-running dispute. Morocco's royal court says Washington will open a consulate in the Western Sahara as part of the agreement. Morocco has claimed the territory as its southern provinces in opposition to the Polisario Front based in southern Algeria, which has been fighting for independence for Western Sahara. Daniel Mwambonu, the head of the Global Pan-Africanism Network, shared his reaction to the U.S. proclamation with VOA via WhatsApp.
United States' recognition of sovereignty of Kingdom of Morocco of Western Sahara is another escalation in U.S. foreign interference in African affairs. Western Sahara is a disputed territory which was occupied by Morocco since 1975, and the people in Western Sahara have all rights to self-determination, and the UN Security Council extended the mandate of the UN mission for referendum in Western Sahara by 13 votes just recently. So this move by United States is a big blow to democracy and undermines the efforts that United Nations is making to resolve the conflict. I appeal to the African Union to step up so that there is no further escalation of the conflict, and ensure that United States respects the sovereignty of Africa to determine its own issues, and also respects the decisions that are made by United Nations so that the people in Western Sahara can be given the right to determine their destiny.
VOA also reached out to President-elect Joe Biden's transition team, and they declined to comment on the situation for now. United Nations spokesman Stéphane Dujarric provided this statement, quote, on the sovereignty issue, the Secretary General's position remains unchanged. He remains convinced that a solution to the question of Western Sahara is possible, that it is in accordance with relevant Security Council resolutions. Now, to dive deeper into the impact of these recent developments, I reached out to Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst with the Rain Company's Stratfor via Skype.
This is a major diplomatic victory after years of lobbying for Morocco to gain this recognition of sovereignty. This is by far the most powerful country to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over this territory, but it brings a lot of risks for Morocco. Domestic backlash over the Israel-Palestine issue, as well as the risk that this deal doesn't actually come to fruition. With the incoming administration, we could see it not be implemented.
What realistically does the impact of the Trump administration recognizing Western Sahara as part of Morocco do?
Achieving this kind of recognition and the promise of a potential U.S. consulate set up in the Western Sahara is a really important thing for Morocco's strategy of achieving de facto control over this territory, even if it doesn't have de jure control over this territory yet. So it is really important for Morocco. I think, though, other countries in Africa, in Europe, are going to be looking to see, whether this is actually implemented in practice. And that's going to help those countries make their own decisions about how they move forward on the issue. But for Morocco, it does fit a very clear purpose. This is one of their most important issues in terms of national security. They view it as really achieving full territorial sovereignty. This in and of itself is a boon to Morocco.
Now, since this is disputed territory, does it create any problems for Morocco on the continent?
With respect to Morocco's relationships with the rest of Africa, I do think that this is very complicated. The Western Sahara issue is the primary reason for the ongoing conflict and the closed border between Morocco and Algeria. It's very complicated with respect to West African relations. Some countries support Morocco's claims, other countries do not. And it was the primary reason for a huge amount of tension between the African Union and Morocco for years. So as Morocco has been engaging in this deepening strategy to boost investment in and exports to sub-Saharan Africa, this issue could result in some cold shoulders to Morocco moving forward across the continent.
I want to switch gears for just a second in the time that we have left and talk about the other announcement, and that was the normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. What's your takeaway from this action?
I think that many Moroccans are going to be concerned about whether this means Morocco has changed its position on Palestinian statehood. And the king and the Moroccan government have been very clear so far that no, the Moroccan position on that has not changed. But I do think that Morocco joining the ranks of other Arab states, Muslim states that are looking at what they could gain pragmatically from better relations with Israel and better relations with the United States, I do think that that does carry the risk of some domestic popular backlash from people within Morocco who don't want their country to move too fast on that and potentially abandon the Palestinian cause.
One last question really quickly here. What else are you looking at?
There have been some altercations along the border. And I think that it's going to be really important to watch what actually happens on the ground in some of that disputed territory. There are those within the Polisario who are very upset right now with how this dispute is going. This U.S. recognition might inflame that further. So I do think we've got to watch for reports on the ground out of that disputed territory to see if unrest develops.
Emily Hawthorne is a Middle East and North Africa analyst with Stratfor, a RAIN company. VOA has continued coverage on our companion programs, Daybreak Africa and Africa News Tonight, as well as on our website, voanews.com. The stalemate over Brexit trade talks continues, and Britain's foreign minister says negotiations on the deal will likely end this weekend. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
To prepare for a possible no-deal exit on the 1st of January, the EU has set down a measure of proposals to make sure air and road traffic continues as normal. It also proposes that fishermen will still have access to each other's waters for up to a year to limit the commercial damage of a no-deal split. The plan depends on the UK offering similar initiatives. UK Foreign Minister Dominic Raab says although they want to make a deal, there are many differences on both sides.
We're not going to sacrifice the basic points of democratic principle, on fisheries, on control over our laws as we leave the transition period. And I think it's important that's recognized.
Karen Chamath, London.
U.S. President Donald Trump pushed ahead Thursday with his long shot effort to upend his re-election loss to President-elect Joe Biden, meeting at the White House with Republican state attorneys general who are supporting a lawsuit brought by the state of Texas at the Supreme Court to attempt to invalidate millions of votes in four states won by Biden. The Supreme Court gave the states until Thursday to respond to the suit, but their state attorneys general disparaged the legal effort as misguided. Facebook could be forced to sell its prized assets, both WhatsApp and Instagram, after the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and nearly every U.S. state filed lawsuits against the social media company. Reuters' Francesca Lana has those details.
For nearly a decade, Facebook has used its dominance and monopoly power to crush smaller rivals and snuff out competition.
Facebook is being sued by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and nearly every U.S. state, who say the company broke antitrust law. But how likely is it that Facebook will be forced to sell its prized assets, WhatsApp and Instagram? Reuters social media reporter Elizabeth Culliford.
It's possible. Breakups have been done before. One expert that Reuters spoke to said that the case was strong on its merits. One antitrust expert that Reuters spoke to predicted the case could take years of litigation, so we might expect a long legal battle. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has previously said that Facebook would go to the mat to fight a legal challenge against the breakup of the company. We reported yesterday that in a post on an internal discussion platform, Facebook, that Zuckerberg said the lawsuits were just one step in a process that could take years to play out in its entirety.
Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion in 2012 and WhatsApp for $19 billion in 2014. Experts say it's particularly difficult to unwind a consummated merger that's been in place for years, not to mention the fact that the Federal Trade Commission cleared those purchases at the time.
The lawsuits are the biggest antitrust cases in a generation, comparable to the lawsuit against Microsoft in 1998, which the federal government eventually settled. But this breakup remedy, while it's not common, even on a small scale, it has been done, it has happened. The Justice Department in 2014 undid the deal between two consumer review sites, Bizarre Voice and Power Reviews. And then most famously, it forced the breakup of the telephone company AT&T back in 1982.
Facebook believes it can prevail in court. Their general counsel, Jennifer Newstead, called the lawsuits revisionist history and said that the evidence will show that Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp belong together. She also argued that WhatsApp and Instagram have succeeded after Facebook invested billions of dollars in growing the apps. With no criminal charges in the lawsuit, it looks as though there's not much incentive for Facebook to cut a deal either.
Francesca Lana reports for Reuters News. And coming up later.
Misinformation is not accurate information, right? And the person may not know that it's false news, but it just gets transmitted online so rapidly and widely.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Past studies have linked the consumption of sugary drinks with increased risks of illness or even death from a wide range of causes, such as heart disease and cancer. A new study from the University of Southern California suggests that sugar-sweetened beverages also tend to depress the hormones that regulate our appetites and curbs our hunger. It's what tells us that we're full and should stop eating, all of which are factors that can sabotage anyone who is on a weight loss program. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, sugary drinks are among the leading sources of added sugars in U.S. diets and helps propel the obesity epidemic. The study found that already obese women and men, whether they were obese or not, were most affected by the sweet beverage-driven drop in the hunger hormones. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Britain's medicine regulator said anyone with a history of anaphylaxis to a specific medicine or food should not get the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, giving fuller guidance on an earlier allergy warning about the shot. Reuters' Adam Reed has those details.
A warning by Britain's regulators over the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine is only directed at people with a history of certain significant allergic reactions. And it comes after UK officials reported a small number of adverse reactions in people who received the jab on the first day of its rollout. Two cases of anaphylaxis and one possible allergic reaction were recorded, prompting a revision of guidelines. Put simply, anaphylaxis is a condition that can cause throat swelling, breathing difficulty, and problems swallowing. The UK's National Health Service even describes it as severe and sometimes life-threatening. Late on Wednesday, the UK regulator said anyone with a history of anaphylaxis to a vaccine, medicine, or food should not get the vaccine. An expert from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine advised Reuters that anyone who's ever needed to use an EpiPen should delay having this vaccine, at least until a reason for the adverse reaction has been clarified. Severe allergies are very rare, however. That's according to London's Queen Mary Hospital, who also told us that in 2012 there were only 7 hospital admissions per 100,000 people for severe allergies. Some experts Reuters spoke with praised UK regulators' caution, while others, such as a representative of the Mayo Clinic in the US, said these added restrictions in Britain were, quote, overdoing. The vaccine's maker, Pfizer, had excluded people with a history of significant adverse reaction from late-stage trials of its COVID-19 vaccine.
That was Reuters' Adam Reed. Social media on the Internet provides billions of users access to quantities of news and information they wouldn't have had access to some 20 years ago, when newspapers, magazines, and network television news still reigned supreme. Unfortunately, today a lot of that information is false or misleading, yet it continues to be amplified through the same social media where users first encountered it. This has been especially true concerning misinformation about COVID-19. According to a recent report published in Online Information Review, this is largely due to the powerful reactions of fear or anger users experience when reading negative reports, and the fact that people feel that they are less likely to believe misinformation than others. The study issued recommendations to counter misinformation and its effects. Now to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with study co-author Young Chung, an assistant professor of communications at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Chung began by defining misinformation itself.
Misinformation is not accurate information, right? And the person may not know that it's false news, but it just gets transmitted online so rapidly and widely.
What are some examples of misinformation about COVID that you've discovered?
For example, COVID-19 is just a big flu, and we don't need to wear the mask, or wearing the mask is a political issue. And one of them is that eating ice cream can treat the COVID-19 disease. But actually, it's not true, right? All those kind of inaccurate information, which is very, very significant for the current U.S. context.
In simple terms, how did the test work?
So we did a very formal academic study with 1,793 U.S. adults, and we did a panel study, which means that based on the U.S. census data, we randomly send those surveys to participants, and then we got around 2,000 people who sent their answers to the study. At the beginning of the survey, we give them the definition of misinformation. And then we ask them, during the pandemic, have you ever encountered a specific misinformation in your daily life? And we ask them, what may be your emotion triggered by those misinformation? And what may be your impact on yourself and on others in society?
And your studies show that people often have a false sense of their own sophistication when it comes to evaluating information.
In this study, overwhelmingly, we find that people always think like others are vulnerable toward misinformation. But me, right? I'm smart. I'm better. I'm good at identifying misinformation by myself. We find that this phenomenon is prominent in the U.S. context during the pandemic.
Many of your respondents were in favor of government checks on misinformation. What did you and your fellow researchers conclude might help?
From this study, we advise that scientific educators should notify teachers from misinformation and realize its harmful impact. And engaging people's attention about misinformation can help them to identify, evaluate false information. And then prioritizing scientific information to bring people more attention towards the facts. And then in quite a few journalism programs and communication departments, they already start a course about media ethics and media literacy. And some media institutions now in the U.S., they are also doing a better job. When, for example, the president continued posting that he won the election, Twitter marked that it may not be true or different from what the other media posted. So this is another way to help people to identify the misinformation.
What advice would you personally give to social media users?
I have several suggestions. First is that people should improve their own media literacy. You have to think for a second more. And then every time when you see the misinformation, you develop your ability to identify it, right? So that's how we as social media users, we can improve along the way.
That was North Carolina State University Communications Professor Yong Chung speaking to my colleague Adam Phillips. China said on Thursday that it would revoke visa exemption treatment for U.S. diplomatic passport holders visiting both Hong Kong and Macau after the United States imposed financial sanctions and a travel ban on more than a dozen Chinese officials. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has more.
Beijing says it will also implement reciprocal sanctions against some U.S. officials, members of Congress, staff at non-governmental organizations, and their family members. Over what a foreign ministry spokeswoman called vile U.S. behavior on Hong Kong and a dangerous and mistaken path. She declined to give names of those sanctioned or to say when the sanctions would start. The United States imposed financial sanctions and a travel ban on 14 Chinese officials this week over their role in adopting a national security law for Hong Kong and over Beijing's disqualification last month of elected opposition legislators in Hong Kong. Outgoing President Donald Trump is widely seen as seeking to cement his tough-on-China legacy and to box President-elect Joe Biden into taking a similarly hardline position. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, the U.S. Treasury also slapped sanctions on Wang Kuo-kui, an organized crime boss for China's 14K triad, and three entities owned or controlled by him, as part of broader efforts to stamp out corruption in some Asian and African countries. Widely known as Broken Tooth, Wan had close ties to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, a largely ceremonial advisory body, according to the Treasury statement. The China's foreign ministry rejected that claim.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. Driving While Black, Race, Space, and Mobility in America is a documentary by filmmaker Rick Burns and historian Gretchen Soren. The film traces the racial profiling African Americans have encountered on the road since slavery. VOA's Penelope Pulu has this look at the film and speaks with the film's creators.
Driving While Black, a documentary by Rick Burns, chronicles the discrimination and violence African Americans have often encountered while driving.
In order to understand what's happening today, we felt strongly that you had to go all the way back to slavery, because that's the point where freedom is denied and mobility is denied.
The film documents how during the U.S. antebellum era, plantation owners employed slave patrols to monitor and punish slaves who tried to escape. It portrays the slave catchers as a precursor to white supremacists and some local sheriffs of the post-slavery Jim Crow era, who targeted African-American motorists from the 1920s to the 1960s.
Liberty is locomotion. It was a form of self-empowerment. You drive, automobile. You get to go where you want, when you want, not sit in the back of the bus, but also an opening to a whole world of challenge as you now must navigate this spaces where African mobility is seen as worrisome and unpleasant and to be stopped by a large cohort of white Americans.
Perils grew for black motorists at night.
So one of the hazards of driving was encountering people who were less interested in you being in that particular neck of the woods. And I say neck of the woods, a neck in the woods, you know, watch out for, you know, being lynched or being harassed or terrified.
How do you navigate the segregated highways of America if you're an African American, where if your daughter needs to go to the bathroom, if you need to put gasoline in your automobile, if, God forbid, you have a medical emergency, where are you going to sleep? Where are you going to eat? Where are we get your hair done?
The Negro Motorist Green Book listed such places. It was published in 1936 by New York postal carrier Victor Hugo Green and put small African-American businesses across the country on the map. Eventually, says Rick Burns, the expansion of America's highways offered a level of protection to African-American drivers, giving them alternatives to state and local roads. However, the film shows African-American drivers continue to be racially profiled and disproportionately likely to be stopped by the police.
And so if people want to say, what is this thing, structural racism, systemic racism, which has this kind of like abstract quality at first glance, is not abstract. It's profoundly concrete.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States continues to target the terrorist group Al-Qaeda and its deadly affiliates, including Al-Shabaab. Most recently, the State Department designated Al-Shabaab's senior leaders, Abdullahi Osman Mohammed and Malim Ayman, as specially designated global terrorists. Abdullahi Osman Mohammed, also known as Engineer Ismail, is Al-Shabaab's senior explosives expert, responsible for the overall management of the terrorist group's explosives operations and manufacturing. He is also a special advisor to the so-called Emir of Al-Shabaab and is the leader of Al-Shabaab's media wing, Al-Kataib. Malim Ayman is the leader of Jaish Ayman, an Al-Shabaab unit conducting terrorist attacks and operations in Kenya and Somalia. Ayman was responsible for preparing the January 2020 attack on Camp Simba in Manda Bay, Kenya, that killed one U.S. military service member and two American contractors. Al-Shabaab was designated as a terrorist organization in March 2008 and continues to threaten the peace, security, and stability of Somalia as well as Kenya. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement, "The U.S. is committed to disrupting the illicit financing methods of Al-Shabaab, limiting its ability to conduct further attacks against civilians, and supporting the federal government of Somalia in disrupting terrorism finance. This will require working closely with our partners to degrade the terrorist group's capacity and operations, combating its control and influence in East Africa." As a result of these designations, U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with Mohammed and Ayman. Their property and interests in property subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked. In addition, it is a crime to knowingly provide or attempt or conspire to provide material support or resources to Al-Shabaab. These designations are part of a broader effort to counter terrorism overseas, said Nathan Sales, coordinator for counterterrorism. We're bringing all of our tools to this fight, not just sanctions, but also information sharing, counter-messaging, combating travel, and building partner capacity to protect soft targets. Coordinator Sales added, the United States is prepared to target any foreign terrorist group that threatens our citizens, our interests abroad, or our allies. We aim to disrupt terrorist threats like Al-Shabaab with our designations, and these actions will do just that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.